Merhaba, Sensiz Olmaz Sessiz Olmaz girişiminin sunmuş olduğu Konuşma Sırası adlı podcast serisine hoş geldiniz. Ben Özge Genç. Bu girişim yazılı, görsel ve sosyal medya platformlarında, toplantılar ve konferanslarda kadınların görünürlüğünü artırmak için başlatıldı. Konuşma Sırası podcast serisi ise güncel konuları kadın uzmanların perspektifinden dinleyicilere aktarmak ve bu konularda ilham verici bakış açıları sunmak amacıyla yayında. Türkiye'de Mayıs 2023 genel seçimlerinin ardından Türkiye Büyük Millet Meclisi yeni yasama yılına başladı. Peki bu dönemde dünya genelinde sıkça tartışılan toplumsal cinsiyete ya da cinsiyet eşitliğine duyarlı parlamentolar, yani gender sensitive parliament konusunda siyasi partilere, üye milletvekilleri ve yasama uzmanları neler yapabilir? Önce bu kavramların ne ifade ettiğini anlayalım. Konuşmacımız Avustralya Ulusal Üniversitesi Pasifik Çalışmaları Başkanı Sonia Palmieri. Sonia'nın uzmanlık alanlarından biri özellikle parlamentolar gibi siyasi kurumlarda kadın liderliğini mümkün kılan ya da kılmayan sosyal ve kültürel koşulları anlamak. Mülakat İngilizce, Türkçe altyazılı versiyon için YouTube videosunu kullanabilirsiniz. Kısaca bu programda neler konuştuk? Parlamentolarda kadın temsiliyeti ve toplumsal cinsiyet duyarlılığı iki farklı konu. Kadınların parlamentoda temsil edilmesi toplumsal cinsiyet duyarlılığını otomatik olarak artırmaz. Bu nedenle sadece kadınların parlamentoda temsil sayısına odaklanmak yeterli değil. Sonia programda parlamentolarda toplumsal cinsiyet eşitliğine yönelik yapılan değişimin sadece kadınlara yüklenen bir sorumluluk haline gelebildiğini ve gelmemesi gerektiğini tartıştı. Programda ayrıca politikanın genellikle erkeklerin alanı olarak algılandığını ve kadınların kendi tercihleri doğrultusunda neden politikadan uzak durduklarını ele aldık. Bu konuyla ilgili olarak Sonia, kamusal alanda özellikle kadın siyasetçilere ve parlamentodaki kadın vekillere yönelik var olan tutumun cinsiyetçilik olarak açıkça tanımlanmasının önemini vurguladı. Daha önce bu konuda netlik olmadığını, ancak asıl meselenin kadınların siyasi katılımını sürekli olarak değersizleştiren cinsiyetçilik olduğunu belirtti. Sonia'ya göre dünyanın her yerinde politik rekabet, çekişme ve politik güç çerçevesinde cinsiyetçilik politikanın ayrılmaz bir parçası haline geldi. Sonia bu konuyu Pasifik ülkeleri bağlamında ele aldı programda. Konuşma sırası Sonia Palmieri ile devam ediyor. Sonia, I assume when we talk about gender-sensitive parliaments, we are not only talking about the presence of women parliamentarians, political representation of more women, but rather a broader spectrum of considerations. Could you tell us what does it mean for a parliament to be gender-sensitive?
Özge, that's completely true. It's much more than just women and the numbers of women. The definition of gender-sensitive parliaments has actually itself evolved over the last 10 years or so, from when we first introduced it through an interparliamentary union report called Gender-Sensitive Parliaments, a global review of good practice. But I think more recently, we have really honed in on the idea that a gender-sensitive parliament needs to be driven by a culture, by a parliament that values and prioritizes gender equality as an objective of what it is doing. So it has to be a social objective of the work of parliament. It has to be a political objective of the work of parliament, an economic objective of the work of parliament. And for a gender-sensitive parliament to really be true to those principles, it actually has to transform and reorient all of the way in which it works towards those objectives. So that's why it's more than just the number of women. It's about the value and the priority that the parliament places on the objective of gender equality as a whole objective of its work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So could you explain the mechanisms and safeguards that are typically implemented for promoting gender sensitivity in the parliaments? I'm aware of the numerous guidelines and reports on this topic, some of which I will include in the description of the program. But in addition to the mechanisms and safeguards, I'm also interested in understanding who typically takes ownership of these plans and how are they scrutinized?
It's a really good question. So what we know is that gender-sensitive parliaments are only realised when the parliamentary leadership takes it seriously, and more often than not, that that parliamentary leadership is held by men. And I think it's really important to understand that it's no one person's responsibility, it is the entire parliament's responsibility. Mm. And that includes people who work for the parliamentary administration and, of course, this kind of new category, I think, of parliamentary workers, political staff as well. So what we know is that a kind of a really important first step to realise a gender-sensitive parliament is to assess the level of gender sensitivity, the existing baseline, if you like. And as you say, there are lots of guidelines and toolkits available from a range of different organisations now that help parliaments either have someone external to the parliament do that kind of assessment, and we call that more of an audit, or for the parliament themselves to reflect on various processes within the parliament and then consider what the recommendations are. Once you've done that, then, of course, the idea is that you would need to have a new plan. And the new plan, for it to be, I think, really effective, has to cover different parts of the work of parliament. So it might cover the representative part of the parliament. To what extent are representatives gender balanced or gender diverse? To what extent does representation happen in a way that manages to balance work and family life, not just for parliamentarians, but for staff as well? To what extent does representation include the legitimate representation of diverse interests across the spectrum of our societies? Mm. So that might be one way in which you look at representation, but of course then there is also legislation and oversight, and those things also have to be undertaken with a gender-sensitive lens. So there are many, many aspects of Parliament's work that have to be gender sensitized, if you like. Of course, all of that needs to be reviewed, it needs to be resourced. And if you don't review it on an annual or even a biannual basis, you don't see whether the baseline information that you collected at the beginning with the assessment has improved or gone not improved, in fact regressed. So if you think about it, the kind of the mechanisms are circular, they never stop. You start with an assessment, you implement, you resource it, you review it, you start again.
Yeah, just to have a better understanding of it, in your experience, what is one, or if you prefer, two notable best practice that has been effective in promoting gender sensitivity in parliaments? And maybe while discussing this, it will be great if you could highlight a major challenge faced in this regard and how it was overcome.
So, Oscar, you might not be surprised to hear this as a response, but I don't think that one measure makes a gender-sensitive parliament. So the best thing that a parliament can do is to review and to have a think about how gender-sensitive it is and to not focus only on the number of women, because I think that really just misdirects attention from and it also always continuously puts the responsibility for gender sensitive change on women. And I think that's a really important kind of consideration. So the really important aspect is for the parliamentary leadership to accept a review of some kind. And I would suggest that externally sourced reviews have been very influential in creating comprehensive change. We see that, for example, in the Westminster Parliament in the UK. In 2016, the academic Professor Sarah Childs went to the Houses of Parliament on a secondment, and she wrote a report with 43 recommendations to become for that parliament to become what she called diversity sensitive. In a similar kind of way, the Australian Parliament has been subject to a review from the Australian Human Rights Commission in 2021 that was catalysed by allegations of sexual misconduct. And the Australian Human Rights Commission produced a report on the basis of hearing 1,700 pieces of evidence, and produced a report with 28 recommendations, which are currently being implemented. And then the oversight of those implementation of those recommendations is the responsibility of a parliamentary leadership task force, which includes quite senior leaders in the parliament. So these are two examples of externally motivated reviews and or externally sourced reviews, and I think that they have been very comprehensive.
Are there any internally motivated reviews or developments that you can think about?
Yes, it is true. I mean, like the Interparliamentary Union, for example, with its evaluation of gender-sensitive parliaments, it has done, it has facilitated internal reviews in countries like Rwanda, in countries like Chile, a number of different countries. Now, they are less public, those kinds of processes. They are for parliaments, by parliaments, internally to parliaments. So there's less ability to check where the status of those recommendations are from an outsider kind of perspective. I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, as long as there is progress.
Another question, I will get back to the numbers issue though, but we know that the discussion is not limited to the numbers. I think we should emphasize it as much as we can. But what are your thoughts on the use of gender quotas in parliamentary representation? Do you see them as an effective tool for achieving women participation in politics, or are there potential drawbacks to consider?
They definitely do improve the number of women in parliament. There is no denying the evidence that quotas implemented in over 100 countries now have improved the number of women in parliament. I think that there are important differences between the idea of quotas being effective for women's political participation and women's quotas necessarily being effective for gender-sensitive parliaments. When you have more women in parliament, there is more likelihood that the parliament will address its level of gender sensitivity. That is a fact. But it doesn't mean that you will have greater gender sensitivity just because you have more women. Not all women in the first instance are interested in parliaments that are gender sensitive. I don't think that that's a given. But also, if you haven't got a kind of a pre-existing culture that accepts the need to talk about gender equality, it's very hard for any woman to talk about it and to progress legislation that is gender sensitive or cultural change that is gender sensitive. And I think if we continue to put the responsibility for gender sensitive or diversity sensitive change on women, it will be ineffective. It's also an unrealistic expectation on women.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for this insight. So there seems to be a social and cultural foundation to the issue of women's participation in politics, with politics being traditionally seen as a male domain and public policy often dominated by male decision makers or bureaucrats. Considering this, if it comes to women's own choices, what factors typically deter women from actively participating in these areas? And why do you think more women are not aggressively pursuing roles in the political scene? Because you've been working with the parliaments and you've been working with this issue for a long time. You have great experience. So I guess you could give some insights about women's own choice of staying away from politics and political representation.
It certainly makes a lot of sense, Oscar. I think we are naming more clearly the sexism that exists in parliaments around the world. Maybe previously we weren't as clear in what we called it, but it is definitely sexism that continues to undervalue women's political participation and leadership. It is a kind of a misogyny that kind of suggests that women cannot contribute to political debate like men can. And part of that for me is the kind of the equation of political combativeness, political adversarialism, political accountability with what is essentially sexism. And so, you know, to be politically robust, you have to be sexist. And that's okay. So the kinds of sexist commentary that happens in parliament, the kind of sexist behavior, what we essentially know as misconduct has been approved of or has not been kind of criticized, as not being called out, because we thought that was an integral part of how politics is done. But it is not, and it is not acceptable, and it's not good for anyone. Just because it's not good for women, it's actually not good for men either. It's not good for anyone. So I think we have to continue to disabuse this kind of relationship between political accountability and sexism. We can have political accountability and respect in a parliament. It doesn't have to be sexist. It doesn't have to deny women's own legitimacy, their own ways of doing politics. And women don't have to be like men. They don't have to be held to a particularly poor standard of behaviour to be seen as capable of being political actors. And I think that's the real problem. Women continually are seen as not capable of acting like men. Or in many of the countries that I work in the Pacific, there's this kind of sense that you don't want women to be like men. You wouldn't want to put women in an environment which is so aggressive and mean and adversarial. So we treat women like, you know, kind of little dolls. And then we say, but then they don't have enough confidence. Well, actually, you've always said that they couldn't do it. So now you're saying they don't have enough confidence. So I think we really need to interrogate, you know, the legitimacy that we give women, that we assume they have or don't have to be able to play in politics. But we could also be doing so much more about the way in which politics is done, which would ultimately attract more women, I think.
Yes, thank you so much, because you also addressed the what should be done question. Thank you very much, Dr. Sonia Palmieri. This was an insightful conversation from which I'm sure we will draw many lessons for Turkey and its parliament in the new term. Thank you very much.
Thank you.